Welcome to Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors. I'm your host, Chris McGregor, and I'm delighted to be joined by Nancy Collins, who is a highly respected journalist who has served as an on-air correspondent for NBC's Today Show and ABC's Primetime Live and 2020, and whose journalistic efforts have appeared in Vanity Fair, Harper's Bazaar, Life, Rolling Stone, Good Housekeeping, and so many others. We're going inside the pages of the memoirs of Archbishop Philip Hannon with Nancy Collins, entitled The Archbishop Wore Combat Boots, From Combat to Camelot to Katrina, Memoir of an Extraordinary Life, published by Our Sunday Visitor. Welcome, Nancy. I really appreciate you joining us today.
Well, I'm thrilled to be here.
What a fascinating story.
Thank you.
Oh, my goodness. Now, he's your cousin, Archbishop
Hannon.
He is my
second cousin. He was my dad's best friend when they were both growing up in Washington, D.C. They were the sons of Irish immigrants.
Oh, the stories you must have heard.
Oh, I grew up hearing about, of course, he wasn't called the Archbishop in those days. He was called Phil by my father. So
sure.
Phil theoretically played a big part in my childhood. I heard many stories about him. And the first time I actually realized kind of his place in the world was the day of the Kennedy funeral, JFK's funeral, and we were living in Montana. The rest of the family was in Washington, and I remember sitting on my living room floor watching our black and white Zenith television, and the family had called and said that Father Phil, as we called him in the family, that Father Phil was going to give the eulogy at President Kennedy's funeral.
Wow.
And it was a big deal because, of course, it should have been technically Archbishop O'Boyle, who was the Archbishop of Washington, but Jackie Kennedy made the personal choice that she wanted. He was then Bishop Hannon, and she said, when Sergeant Shriver said to her, "But you can't do that," she said, she dug in her heels, and she said, "It's Hannon or nobody."
Wow, wow. Let's explore the life of this wonderful man. I mean, I really got to know him in the beautiful writing that you've done in the Archbishop Wore Combat Boots. Of course, that is the extraordinary life of Archbishop Philip Hannon. But I don't think people appreciate just how extraordinary it is.
It's a long one. You know, he's 97 years old.
God bless him.
Uh-huh, absolutely, and still kicking.
Wow.
Walks a mile or so every day. He is an extraordinary man. You know, as I said earlier, he's the son of an Irish immigrant, and when he went to wonderful schools in Washington, and he didn't necessarily know he wanted to be. There wasn't like a hallelujah moment about being a priest. It was kind of evolutionary process, and so he became a priest, and then during World War II, he served in the famous 82nd Airborne. He parachuted into the Battle of the Bulge and I think the Ardennes Offensive, and really spent time over there, served in post-war Berlin. And then when he came back to D.C., because he was at St. Matthew's Cathedral in Washington, he became friends with a young congressman called John Kennedy.
Mm.
And, you know, they had a lot in common. Father Phil was only 4 years older than Kennedy, so they're the same age. They're both war heroes. They were both obviously sons of Irish immigrants. It was in the White House that he met Jackie Kennedy, and she called one day and she said she wanted to set up a catechism class for Caroline, and so he helped her do that off site. I think they did it at a nearby Catholic school, and they became great friends. So by the time Kennedy was assassinated, that's when she had formed her opinion about Father Phil, decided that he had to be in the church, he had to be in part of the funeral.
Wow. Again, we're talking about, as you refer to him, Father Phil, as Archbishop.
Well, that's the family calls him that.
That's right.
It's such a force of habit.
No, that's all right. I mean, we're talking about, again, the extraordinary life of Archbishop Philip Hannon, which is chronicled in the Archbishop Wore Combat Boots. Again, God bless him, he's 97 years old, a member of the greatest generation.
He certainly is. I mean, in fact, I sent Tom Brokaw a book yesterday, and Tom's going to give me a quote. He knows Father Phil because the Archbishop, of course, New Orleans, we're talking about. Father Phil was the Archbishop of New Orleans from 1965 to 1989, and he was very He was one of the organizers of the World War II Museum in New Orleans.
Just that part of his life is a wondrous tale.
Well, it was interesting about the war because, you know, he was 32, and, you know, he was a little old to go. He had to really fight to get on the front lines, and he wanted to go to the front lines. Mm-hmm. And once he got to the front lines, he not only served there in very arduous times, but he insisted on going to where the battle was. And he would minister, you know, priests or clergymen on the field don't carry any weapons, so he had no gun. And they also help out the enemy soldiers if they're dying or wounded. And so, but Father Phil insisted on that.
Yeah, it's quite a moment when you think about it. His life is not just that time, but all those opportunities where he went to the front line, even when he wasn't on the battlefield in a war zone. I mean, he did that in many areas throughout the culture.
Well, yes, that's a very good observation, Chris, actually, because he is a real frontline guy, even at 97.
Uh-huh.
But he has this remarkable Herculean willpower, and he refuses to quit. He's brilliant. He's a real intellect, and he's witty, very witty and funny, but very kind. He's equally at home with an Irish maid or President Kennedy.
Mm.
And I think that intelligence really came to the fore during Vatican II. He was a part of the American delegation, and I think that was 62 to 65, those years. And, you know, he was the only, again, a maverick stance, but at that time, the Vatican II was, you know, wanted to promulgate an action to ban nuclear weapons.
Mm-hmm.
And Father Phil truly believed, having served in post-war Berlin, he was very much an anti-communist.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided that so he led the charge to say that nuclear weapons should be used as that nuclear weapons were a moral were moral when used as a deterrent.
Sure. Yeah, and that was quite a maverick stance, but having served on those front lines and also his appreciation of what the struggles of the poor, those who are in need. I mean, that must have come from that Irish background, that immigrant background that he himself had to experience.
Well, it did come from that. His father was the brother of my grandmother. And when there were the Hannons and the Collinses, and everybody more or less married each other. I'm surprised we're all sane, but we did.
God bless you
fourth
all.
Fourth and fifth cousins, I guess. But there was this enclave in Washington, and a five-block radius, the Collins and the Hannons. And the Irish that came from Ireland would make their first stop in Washington, and both families would put them up, give them bank accounts, get them on their way. They could stay with the families as long as they needed to. But one thing that the Archbishop's father was a great and early civil rights advocate, taught all of his children not to see color, and the Archbishop continued that throughout his life. And so when he went to New Orleans, which of course in 1965 was hardly a hotbed of integration,
mm-hmm.
He worked very hard there to bring that idea to the city. In fact, there's one instance I always thought was very moving, that at some point the state had to finally issue an edict to they had to integrate the swimming pools.
Mm-hmm.
And so everybody, all the public swimming pools were closing down in order to avoid this. And so the Archbishop went to a private Catholic school, and he integrated that pool again.
Mm-hmm.
and started kind of he was in the forefront of the waves that finally forced that to happen.
Yeah, just remarkable when you think about all of the experiences that he had. He really had the fullness of the 20th century.
Yes, and I mean, even now, like when King Katrina came, and let's see, he was a mere 92 when Hurricane Katrina came, And he, at post, when he retired, he took over a religious television programming, something called Focus Worldwide, which was Catholic programming.
Mm-hmm.
And so in, when Katrina came, he was 92. So he put on the combat boots on the front of the book are the same combat boots he wore in World War II.
Wow.
The very same. And so he put those combat boots on again. He walked, he went down, made his way down to the radio, television station. He barricaded himself in for 3 days. He lived on water and peanut butter crackers and without electricity in order to ward off looters.
Mm.
And then, once he left there, he didn't go home. He talked his way across the police barricades and drove drove alone for 24 miles across what they call the causeway so he could get to evacuees and minister to them.
Mm. Amazing. 92 when 92. This happened.
Well, you know, it was only 3 years ago he called me, and he said, out of the blue, really, and he said, Nancy, I'm writing my memoirs. And I said, well, not a moment too soon, Father Phil. And he laughed, and he said, I want you to look at the Kennedy chapters. And I'd heard the stories over the years, so I did. And, of course, the deal was there. Because that he was, he'd written a lot, but he wasn't a writer per se, and so
mm-hmm.
it was kind of a lot of facts in search of a writer, and so I began volunteering my services as a family deal, and then he had a stroke, and when he came back from that stroke, I realized that if we were going to get the book done in, you know, when he can still enjoy it, because he came back from the stroke just fine, frankly, but still, he was now 96 or whatever it was,
mm-hmm.
95. And so I brought on board another writer, Peter Finney from New Orleans, to help me with that end of it. And so we managed to get it out. Well, certainly, but Father, the Archbishop's really enjoying this, and we were very happy that God let us make that deadline.
As you point out, I mean, you oversaw his and really helped him through those Kennedy chapters. What are some of the things that surprised you as you encountered those memories?
Well, you know, I guess it was, there's so much rich detail. Anybody who loves politics and just straight-on political junkie will love the two Kennedy chapters. But beyond that, and anybody who, we forget how hard it was to get a Catholic elected to office in 1960. And I don't think there's ever been a book that really tells the inside baseball of what the Kennedy campaign had to do, the machinations, in order to make John Kennedy palpable to the general public. And, of course, Father Phil was in on all that because, you know, Kennedy would always call him about, as he said, our relationship was strictly business. But, Kennedy, Father Phil said, Kennedy was more a cultural Catholic than a rigid Catholic. Bobby Kennedy was much more of a strict Catholic. And, you know, during the campaign, Jack Kennedy, was very interested in getting elected. But Father Phil could go with that. You know, he understood that it was important to have, and he understood that Jack Kennedy had faith. It was just a question of how to maneuver that so that people wouldn't be threatened by it in 1960. And, of course, I think one of the highlights of the Kennedy story are the Jackie Kennedy letters, because after 10 days, about 10 days after the funeral, he got a call one day from Jackie Kennedy, who was, of course, bereft, and she said, I want to bring the bodies of the two children we had. She and Kennedy had two children who, one was stillborn, and the other one, I think a lot of people remember, died.
Mm-hmm.
Before they were in office? No, I think when they were in office. And she wanted to bring those little bodies down from Hyannis and bury them next to him in Arlington. And she said, don't tell anybody. So he met her at Arlington a couple nights later. And it was she and her sister, Leah Radziwill, and her mother and a couple friends. And they then Father Phil presided over the interment of the little white caskets near their father in Arlington. It was a very moving scene in the book. And then afterwards, he and Jackie walk around Arlington, and she just kind of explodes with all the questions you have after a tragedy like that, like, why did God let this happen? How am I going to handle this? How can I keep believing in God? you know, given what I've been through, what do I tell the children, etc.? How do I maintain my own sense of self in the midst of this public adulation? So it's quite a moving scene in the book. And in the year afterwards, she wrote him two, I think, remarkable letters, which speak to her pain, her great love for Kennedy, the loss she feels. And after a lot of thought, Father Phil decided to include them in the book because he always believed that despite frankly, now, as we know, facts of his infidelity, mm-hmm. that theirs was a great love affair and there was a great emotional commitment there. And these letters are very moving in her. You know, she says, at one point she says, I'm going to do the best with the years I have left. I hope there aren't many. I mean, she was mm-hmm. bereft. Mm-hmm. And these letters make you feel very differently about Jackie Kennedy, I think, than you may have before.
Yeah, extraordinary chapters, as you pointed out. I mean, the whole book is just filled with gobs of pictures. Throughout the book, the letters.
He saved everything. I mean, I'm a writer, and I don't even keep a diary. We sent the publisher 150 pictures that they had to choose from, which was a gift to them. Mm-hmm. And of course, there's copies of the actual Jackie letters in there, and letters from Kennedy. And you know, then also the Kennedy family also. Ethel asked Father Phil to preside over the interment at Bobby's funeral, at Bobby's graveside, and Caroline Kennedy and Caroline and John Jr. asked the Archbishop to preside over the interment of Jackie's at Jackie's graveside. And so the book begins, the first chapter begins with the Kennedy funeral and ends with at the graveside of Jackie.
That, I think, probably the toughest moment in any funeral liturgy is that interment time when you're actually having to face the reality that the separation is happening. You have to leave this body here and to turn to him in those moments to help make that transition. It says a lot about his spirit, I mean, his soul, how others viewed him.
Well, I think that's a very interesting observation about the interment. I hadn't thought of it that way. Yeah, I think so too. And I think the other thing about the Kennedys, they didn't like a lot of public over sentimentality. Mm-hmm. And they, the eulogy of Jack Kennedy, here's the story, quick story behind that. He was at Vatican II. He heard about Kennedy being assassinated over there. Mm-hmm. He flew back. They got back at 9 o'clock the night before the funeral. And he got the news at 11 o'clock that night that he was meant to do the eulogy.
Wow.
And so he kind of stayed up for a couple of hours. He thought about, probably more than that, and he thought about, what else should I say? And you know, it was very short notice to write probably the most important homily he ever would ever give. Mm-hmm. And he decided to go with the words of the man himself. So he did the readings from the inaugural address, which he thought was just one of the most brilliant speeches ever written. They ask not what you can do for your country. And he did parts of that, plus some scriptural readings of Kennedy Light. And he said, you know, Jackie wanted it short, you know, wanted to keep it short and crisp, as the kids did when she died. But I think they knew they could trust him to be sophisticated and dignified and warm at the same time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you get that throughout the entire book, too.
Well, thank you. We did work on this one because we didn't have much time in the end. We had about 1,000 pages that needed a total rewrite last summer, so we dug into it. And I wrote everything basically through World War II, the Kennedy stuff, the New Orleans Saint, and the end chapter. And then there's a wonderful epilogue the last chapter about love. One day during World War II, then Father Phil was walking down some road in Italy, and he saw this woman coming with her two children in a little cart, and he stopped to see if he could help her. And she was just weeping inconsolably, and he said, "Well, what can I do to help you?" She said, "You can't." She said, "My man is gone. My husband's dead. My man is gone." Mm. And he walked away from her thinking that, you know, in the end, it's all about love. Mm. And the alpha and the omega is love. And when you have that interpersonal love, whether it's with a person or in a greater sense with God, that is the whole raison d'etre of your existence.
Well, we're talking with Nancy Collins, who assisted Archbishop Philip Hannon in his memoirs entitled The Archbishop Wore Combat Boots, From Combat to Camelot to Katrina. Wow. You've got to throw Ireland in there, too, somehow. You just have to, because that really, when you hear the story, those extraordinary Irish immigrants that came into the country in those early years and just helped shape the whole generations to come.
And you know, the Archbishop's father only went up to the eighth grade, and yet he came over here with $5 in his pocket, and he was highly successful. He ran a big plumbing business, worked very, very hard. There were six kids in the family, five boys and a girl, and Mary, who he always said was the sister Mary, who was the brightest, and alas, died early of breast cancer, just killed the other boys. But those early days were amazing, and you know they were all went to the Catholic schools, and they were big sports fans, and you know they lived very close to the White House, which in those days, the president used to take promenades. So you know he would see the president and his one bodyguard in those days walking right past their house. But that was kind of a given, and they were very disciplined kids. And then one day, as he said, you know, my family's never been the type that push for vocations. you do what you want to do, what makes you. And so one day, Father Phil appeared at the family dinner table and announced, as I said for him in the book, I said, his parents weren't praying for a vocation, they were praying for a doctor or a lawyer. Mm-hmm. And he just announced one day he's going to the seminary, and they all just about fainted. And then he went to Ireland at one point to see. He thought, you know, we didn't have many priests or nuns in the family here, but he thought surely in Ireland, and he laughs when he tells his story. He went there and he said there wasn't one Father Hannon in all of Ireland.
Wow.
From his family.
Uh-huh.
So he was and my father used to say, because they used to pal around, they were the same age, and Daddy said that everybody was so shocked when Phil went to the sim, because he's a very good-looking guy and very popular with the girls and so forth. But, you know, he had a calling, and he had, when you read about this man who started out his career before he went to Washington and Maryland, in those days going door to door, just knocking on doors and doing the religious census and just talking to people one-on-one, and the heights to which he rose. And, he, you know, New Orleans was a perfect fit for him because, you know, New Orleans is, we all know New Orleans is one of the most fascinating cities in the world. It's got a lot of personality. It's got a lot of quirkiness. And Father Phil could really roll with that. He has a personality as big as the town.
Mm.
And he was very popular. The first time I went down there when he was Archbishop, I remember I mentioned I was his cousin. Well, I said to him, this is better than saying I'm related to Mick Jagger.
Yeah, I would say so.
He was a big deal. I mean, everybody knew the Archbishop. And, you know, he's a great friend of the New Orleans Saints, because when they built the Super Bowl, he gave the, I guess, invocation when they started digging up the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very funny, famous one, something along the lines of, you know, God... God has, you know, I guess something has tamed the lions, and he sort of added, and the Cubs, and the and the Colts. But also, when they were getting the franchise in New Orleans, he's a great friend of Tom Benson, the owner of the Saints. The governor called Father Phil, then the Archbishop, and said, look, we're thinking about naming the team the Saints. Will the Catholic Church have any problem with that? And he said, well, no, the church won't have any problem, but I do want to point out that all saints are martyrs. So I'm not sure if we want our team going on the field with that idea.
Mm-hmm.
And he had, Father Phil then had had a second stroke last October.
Mm-hmm.
He had another stroke, and where he actually had the last rites, at which point I called him up at one point. I said, put the phone to his ear, and I said, Father Phil, we have worked so hard. You got to get in there and sell this book. You can't go anywhere. And bless his heart, he didn't. He recovered, but to the tune of being able to go to the Super Bowl in Tom Benson, the owner's plane, and he got to sit in Tom Benson's box and watch the Saints undo their martyrdom.
Well, praise God he lived long enough to see that.
Absolutely.
Hopefully he'll probably, from what you say, it sounds like he's got that stout heart that he will be around for many years to come, probably.
Well, he keeps surprising us, and you know, he still has projects. He gets up in the morning, wants to do things, and his speech is a little impaired from the last stroke, but it's coming back, you know.
Mm-hmm.
But part of it's that willpower, that real drive, that need to serve. Mm-hmm. And he is a man who is, the great experience for me was getting, my father died when I was 18, Chris, and so it was a great experience for me to be able to spend some time, a lot of time actually, with one of my father's great friends, because he's probably the last person on earth who knew my father. Although Father Phil has one remaining brother named Jerry who's 88 and sharp as a tack, man.
Mm-hmm.
So it kind of runs in the fact. See, his mother was German. Father Phil's mother was German, mm-hmm. of German extraction. She's a brilliant, really educated woman. And I always say to him, you know, it's a good thing. I think that German blood is pumping through you because you're still around and all the Irish relatives are gone.
What a combination.
Yeah.
What a combination. Yeah, we're talking with Nancy Collins, who wrote with her wonderful relative, Archbishop Philip Hannon, the extraordinary memoirs of that are contained in the Archbishop wore combat boots from combat to Camelot to Katrina. I just wish we had more time to talk, but this is what's so great about the book, because if you pick it up now, you can enter into this wonderful life and to be able to experience it as well.
Thank you so much, because we wanted it to read almost novelistically, and I think it kind of does, because there was so much America to cover in this, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so much church history. And so we wanted to get as much in as we could.
Nothing boring about it. Nancy Collins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you so much. I really appreciate this, dear.
We've been going inside the pages of The Archbishop Wore Combat Boots, From Combat to Camelot to Katrina, The Memoirs of an Extraordinary Life, from Archbishop Philip Hannon with author Nancy Collins. You can find this book at oursundayvisitor.com or at any fine Catholic bookstore. I'm your host, Chris McGregor. To hear and download this discussion along with many others, please visit www.insidethepages.com. I'm Chris McGregor. Join me next time for Inside the Pages, insights from today's most compelling authors.